You're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm joined this afternoon on the phone by Adam Shapiro. He is an organizer and activist with the International Solidarity Movement. We're going to be talking about an article in Mother Jones Magazine, the latest Mother Jones, which is the September-October 2003 issue. We're going to be talking about an article called Death of an Activist. Was Rachel Corrie a Martyr or a Fool? Written by Joshua Hammer, and getting Adam Shapiro's response. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Can you hear me well?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining me. So, unfortunately, you weren't able to obtain a copy of the article beforehand, but you were briefed on it by someone else who read it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to ask you about a few parts I've highlighted here. I'm going to start by reading you a clip of a description about of the International Solidarity Movement and get your response, okay?
Okay, that's great.
Joshua Hammer writes, "In the fall of her senior year, a friend returned from 5 months in Gaza and talked enthusiastically to Corrie about the International Solidarity Movement, a pro-Palestinian activist group founded just the year before. A motley collection of anti-globalization and animal rights activists, self-described anarchists and seekers, most in their 20s, the International Solidarity Movement upholds the right of Palestinians to carry out, quote, armed struggle, unquote, and seeks to, quote, establish divestment campaigns in the U.S. and Europe to put economic pressure on Israel the same way the international community put pressure on South Africa during the apartheid regimes, unquote. Can I get your response to that quote from the article, Adam?
Sure. Well, Mr. Hammer is quite incorrect, and I don't know where he did his research. I don't believe he spoke to anybody directly from the International Solidarity Movement. But our numbers of participants are now well over 2,000 people from around the globe who've joined us. And the average age, I would say, of our activists is probably people in their 40s is the average age. We certainly do have a number of a good number of students who join us in their 20s, people who are younger in the 20 to 30 age range, but we have equally as high numbers of people in their 60s and 70s, and even we've had people in their 80s who've come and joined us in the occupied Palestinian territories. And I would say that we are hardly a motley crew, but rather people who are long-time have been involved with this issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, of occupation, and of injustice in the Holy Land. And I would say that his characterization is one based probably from reading articles or in the New York Post or the Jerusalem Post rather than trying to access information directly by talking to people from the International Solidarity Movement.
And isn't it true that about one quarter of the International Solidarity Movement, of the people that make up the ISM, are Jewish?
Indeed, this is true. Not only are one quarter of the ISM activists, the internationals who come, Jewish, either Jewish American or European Jews, but also we have worked with and a number of Israelis have also participated in International Solidarity Movement actions. I should also say that whereas Mr. Hammer is correct in quoting that we do support the Palestinian right to armed struggle as an occupied people, according to international law, we do not sanction or endorse in any way targeting civilians. And I should also say that we do not necessarily, we support the divestment movement internationally, but that is hardly the limit or the scope of our activities. In fact, we're very much an activist, direct action oriented group committed to the principles and the tactics of nonviolent resistance, and we are engaged on the ground in not just protesting, but actually removing the tools of occupation and oppression.
Wasn't the group founded by Israelis and Palestinians?
One of the original founders is indeed an Israeli. Her name is Netta Golan. And she working together with Palestinians and internationals together, yes.
Let's talk about this accusation that the ISM upholds the right of Palestinians to carry out, quote, armed struggle. Now, my understanding from looking at the website, at the ISM website, is that what it says, actually, the exact quote, is that the international solidarity movement recognizes the Palestinians' right to legitimate armed struggle, meaning by legitimate, what do you mean?
By legitimate, we mean what is acceptable under international law, according to the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves as an occupied people. When the Israeli army enters into a city or a town or a village and are attacking using the weapons of war, basically tanks and F-16s and Apache helicopters and of course, guns shooting around in the place, we do acknowledge that the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves, and unfortunately it means that when they're facing an army that they're going to use weaponry. We do, additionally, an occupied people, according to the Geneva Conventions, has a right to resist against that occupation, and, you know, to use weapons to do so apparently is sanctioned by international law. We, the ISM, do not engage in any of this kind of activity. Rather, we believe and we work on using strategies of nonviolent resistance, and so that's how we work. But again, we do not sanction or endorse or condone the use of violence against civilians in any way whatsoever. So those who try to allege that we support the suicide bombings or these kinds of things against civilians are this is false.
There's, you know, the Israeli government itself recognizes the Palestinians' right to resist with legitimate armed struggle because they're signatories to the Geneva Convention, which grants that right.
Indeed. I mean, we wish Israel would uphold the Geneva Conventions in general regarding occupied territories, but clearly they don't. And they do wish to have a double standard. They do wish to be able to use violence and their army in implementing policies against the Palestinians, and then wish the Palestinians to, of course, sit by passively, and they do not even wish them to resist nonviolently, and that you know is certainly indicated in the Israeli army's response to people like Rachel Corey, who was run over by a bulldozer trying to protect a home, Brian Avery, who was shot in the streets of Jenin by Israeli gunmen when he was trying to make sure the residents of that city where he was living in Jenin were safe. Also, Tom Herndahl, who was also shot in the head in Gaza by an Israeli sniper, who was trying to protect Palestinian children who are out in the streets of Rafah. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I want to talk about each one of those things a little bit more in depth a little bit later in the interview, because they do address that in the article, and they present the Israeli army, you know, version of events. So I would like to get your response to that a little bit later. But let me quote further about the description that Joshua Hammer has of the ISM here. He says, "The group has courted controversy from the start, embracing Palestinian militants, even suicide bombers, as freedom fighters. ISM has adopted a risky policy of, quote, direct action, entering military zones to interfere with the operations of Israeli soldiers." Can I get your response to that, please?
Well, I'm not sure what he thinks he's saying by saying we court controversy. We are situating ourselves in the occupied Palestinian territories. And this is a term, occupied territories, or the West Bank and Gaza, that people forget, and even journalists fall into this trap. They forget that this is actually the place where people live and where they call their homes. And so we situate ourselves and put ourselves with people in their homes, with people on their land, on farmland, in order to try to provide some measure of protection, an international presence to protect Palestinians. We have seen, I lived there from before the beginning of the Intifada, and I saw even before the beginning of the Intifada that Palestinians were, civilians were at risk of being attacked by Israeli soldiers, by Israeli settlers, and there was really nobody doing anything about it, nobody in the international community. The Palestinians have long been asking for an international protection force and have not received one because the United States and Israel, the United States vetoes it in the Security Council, and the Israel, of course, opposes it in the United Nations. So to say that we are looking for this in some way, that we're thrill seekers, is false. What I would say is that the international solidarity movement, and of course the international activists themselves, in particular the American citizens who join us, are in fact taking responsibility for international policy regarding this land. Right now, and for the last decades, there has been no international body, no organization, no state that has been able to hold Israel accountable for the lives of Palestinian people. And we, especially Americans as taxpayers, are contributing to that because it is our tax money that is going to pay for the Israeli military, which is then used on Palestinian civilians in the occupied territories. So we are taking responsibility by putting ourselves there, by bearing witness, by standing in the way of soldiers, Israeli soldiers and Palestinian civilians, and saying, no, you cannot get away with simply shooting these people or corralling them into pens or putting up walls around their homes or cutting off their land or bulldozing their homes or cutting down their trees without somebody being there to try and prevent it and also to bear witness.
So you don't embrace militants. What you're doing in these quote-unquote military zones is you're living with civilians and protecting civilians from aggression by Israeli soldiers. Is there any evidence whatsoever, is there any accusation from the Israeli government or military that you embrace militants? And can you please answer this claim that Joshua Hammer makes that you embrace suicide bombers as freedom fighters?
Certainly not. I think all of us who've lived in the occupied territories, who've lived with the Palestinian people, have seen the devastating effects of the occupation on the Palestinian people. And one of these terrible, devastating effects is that a culture has been created in a sense of people who don't see any difference between living and dying. That's how bad life has become for them. And so some people have indeed turned themselves into human bombs and have gone and exploded themselves, often killing and injuring other civilians and innocent people. And we find this a tragedy for all people involved, from the victims of the attacks to the people who are carrying out these attacks to the families of the bombers who are left behind. And we don't, I don't believe any ISMer has ever used the term freedom fighter to refer to the people who carried out these attacks. But we also understand that, you know, to simply label them a terrorist and to whitewash it that way is failing to understand the complex nature of this occupation, of what Palestinians' lives are like, and I think perhaps the only way he can perhaps suggest that we embrace these people, which I think is the wrong term to use, is that we do not believe that it is right or that the Israeli army should have the right to go and bulldoze the homes of people who've carried out suicide attacks, because families live in these homes. And I know from personal experience that 99.9% of the time, the families of the bombers themselves do not know that their son or daughter, in some cases, is involved in doing this kind of attack until the attack happens. And to hold those people guilty in a form of collective punishment, which, of course, is also against international law and Geneva Conventions, is also a violation of human rights, and we are doing what we can to protect human rights and to stand in the way of this kind of aggression.
Part of the reason why the families are not made aware of this is because the people who train the suicide bombers don't want the family to try to talk them out of it. Isn't that right?
Certainly, that's one reason. Another reason, of course, is because Israel has a large network of collaborators, people who have been held, Palestinians who have been held in Israeli jails, who have been threatened with torture, or who have in fact been tortured, who are then, you know, co-opted into being collaborators. And of course, there's a lot of undercover type of work in going on by Israel in the occupied territories. And so, yeah, there's a lot of secrecy involved.
Let's talk about some of the accusations that have come down. Currently, the Israeli government and military is not accusing the ISM of harboring terrorists, right?
That's correct.
Okay, they've withdrawn that claim.
Mm-hmm.
But let me quote from Joshua Hammer's piece here again. And again, you're listening to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm interviewing Adam Shapiro. And he is an organizer and activist with the International Solidarity Movement. We're talking about an article written by Joshua Hammer in the latest Mother Jones magazine. It's called Death of an Activist. It's about Rachel Corrie and the International Solidarity Movement. So I quote from the article again. ISM has also found itself placed on the defensive by its own recklessness. During a raid on their Jenin office on March 27th, Israeli soldiers arrested Shadi Sukiya, an alleged Islamic Jihad guerrilla found hiding with two ISM activists. The IDF says that Sukiya, 20, was, quote, a senior militant, unquote, who'd sent four suicide attackers into Israel. ISM insists he was an innocent, terrified teenager who'd asked for refuge during an Israeli sweep. But following the incident, the International Committee for the Red Cross, which occupies an office in the same compound, asked the ISM to leave the premises. Can you talk about that incident, Adam, please?
The incident occurred on an evening in Jenin when the city had been open, in a sense, for one of the first times in many days, where there was not curfew during the day. And so people were out in the street and going about doing their business. As it got dark, I believe it was also raining, the army came into the town and pronounced curfew, and people were scrambling to get to their homes. This young man came to our office. He had been caught in this part of town away from his home and was trying to get inside a building to not be outside and exposed to the Israeli army. As we well know, and it's been well documented by various international agencies and even Israeli human rights groups, the Israeli army will shoot to kill in order to enforce curfew. So this gentleman, this young man, was trying to find a way to preserve his life and seek shelter. He'd been searching in this building where the ISM has an apartment, not an office, and had been trying different doors to see if anybody was around, and the only people who were around at that time were people with the ISM in our apartment there. And he came inside when the IDF showed up into the building. They were going building to building doing sweeps. Our activists opened the door. They let the army right in, and then they took this man away. They had originally alleged that they also found a gun in our apartment, which they later retracted the statement. It was completely a falsification. There were no guns found on the premises, either of our apartment or of the building. And as for this young man, the ISM has checked into who he was, and we have not been able to find anybody in Jenin to confirm that he was a member of Islamic Jihad. And as far as we know, to this date, Israel has not charged him with any crime. He's still being held in administrative detention, which is a form of imprisonment that Israel has used against thousands of Palestinian prisoners, to simply hold them for 3, 6, 9, 12 months without charge, and just to keep Palestinian men in, basically just to keep them in prison. I am not aware of the Red Cross asking ISM to leave the apartment in Jenin, and as far as I know, we still do have an apartment in Jenin, and I believe in still the same location, so I don't know where he received that information.
Let me quote further from the same paragraph. He goes on to say, in late April, two Pakistan-born Britons posing as activists stopped in for tea at the group's office in Rafah. 5 days later, one Briton blew himself up at the entrance to a Tel Aviv pub called Mike's Place, killing three and wounding dozens. The other escaped, his battered body later washed ashore near Tel Aviv. The ISM denied any link to the bomber. Quote, their sole contact with us was a brief social encounter in Rafah in the Gaza Strip, and no links were forged in such a short time, unquote, a spokesman said. Still, the perception has lingered that the group is a sympathizer or even a harborer of terrorists. Now, Adam, can you describe that situation for us?
Well, going backwards from his statements, first of all, if the IDF or if the Israeli government perceived the ISM to be harboring terrorists in any way, you could be sure that our activists would be arrested, put in jail, and deported from the country. We do not make a secret of our activities. We do not make a secret of where we are located in the occupied territories, and we have had activists who have been arrested and released. And so, if this really was a perception, then we would all come to the conclusion, the rational conclusion, I believe, that Israel would seek to get rid of us completely. They have not done that, and activists continue to enter with Israel's permission into the occupied territories, with their permission in the sense that we need to receive a visa from Israel in order to enter the occupied Palestinian territories. As for the tragic event at Mike's Place and this attack by these two British citizens, it is quite unfortunate for everybody involved that this happened. I will have to say this, though, that the burden of responsibility in this case falls squarely on the shoulders of the Israeli government, and I think this is a complete failure in their security and intelligence abilities. It is it has come to light that these two guys passed through Israeli security checkpoints, and I've been through these checkpoints myself, and I can tell you these are, you know, very, very serious border points, basically. They entered through Israel, entered into Israel via Jordan, and so they crossed a full international border, and then they crossed first into the Gaza Strip through the Erez checkpoint, which is a major security checkpoint, and then came out again from Gaza into Israel through the Erez security checkpoint. This is three encounters with the Israeli security at three very sensitive crossing points into Israel. And Israeli security intelligence operatives had all kinds of opportunities to catch these guys and to discover what they were doing. They could have checked with British intelligence, who apparently had some sort of dossier on these two gentlemen and some of their activities. So the opportunity to catch these guys was there. To the claim that Israel has put out there that that these two guys were pretending to be peace activists or to be working in the solidarity movement, and that's how they were able to get through the checkpoints, this is, of course, completely false. We know, the ISM knows from experience of our legitimate activists, the people who have joined us or have tried to join us, that if you say you're coming to help Palestinians, or if you say you're coming to work with the Palestinian people, or to be an activist, even a peace activist, that the Israeli government will turn you away at the border and will not allow you to enter. And we have had case after case after case of experience of this, where people who have been coming to join the ISM from the United States, from Europe, from Asia, have been turned away simply because they said they were coming to work as an activist with the Palestinian people. And so this idea that these two guys were let in because they said this is totally counterfactual and completely absurd.
What about what were the connections, if any, between the ISM and these two individuals?
As it was said in our statement, they were in Gaza on the same day that the ISM was holding a memorial for Rachel Corrie. They, along with hundreds of other people, came to the ISM office in Rafah and drank tea, as is customary, to drink either tea or coffee with people in mourning. And I think they then proceeded out with hundreds and hundreds of people in Rafah to the spot where Rachel was killed in order to have this memorial service. And that was the extent completely of our communication with these guys. And I feel confident in saying that had any of the ISM activists in Gaza known or heard that these two guys were going to carry out an attack, that they would have brought that to the attention first and foremost of all of the ISM activists, and then secondly, of course, to the proper authorities, because again, we totally do not condone in any way the targeting or attacking of civilians, and we would not have made ourselves party to this in any way.
Actually, on your website, I read a quite strong statement against suicide bombings and attacks on civilians, and I find it interesting that accusation is thrown around, despite the fact that you quite publicly condemn those acts.
Indeed.
I'm going to quote again from the article here. The group has courted controversy. Okay, wait, did I already read that?
I think you got that one already.
I wanted to read you this part. Members held vigil with Yasser Arafat during the siege of his Ramallah headquarters in April of 2002. The next month, 10 activists dashed across Bethlehem's Manger Square in front of astonished Israeli snipers and took refuge alongside 150 Palestinian gunmen trapped inside the Church of the Nativity. Can you respond to that quote, please?
Well, first of all, I was one of the first people to enter the presidential compound in Ramallah, bringing an ambulance and medical attention to the over 300 men inside, who were denied any sort of medical attention or food by the Israeli army.
Is that legal?
That is not legal. That is totally against the Geneva Conventions, the international law, and just simply the rules of war. So we did insert, the ISM didn't try, we were successful in inserting a group of people inside to try to break the siege. The international community was totally paralyzed and doing nothing. The situation was highly tense. And Israel was refusing to lift the siege. We have no personal or political connections to Yasser Arafat or any Palestinian personage or political party whatsoever. the fact, you know, Mr. Hammer's characterization would seem to indicate that the only Palestinian out there is Yasser Arafat, when in fact that there are, you know, a few million Palestinian people, and indeed in the presidential compound at that time were policemen and civil servants and all kinds of people who work in and around the compound. And so we went in there to try and break the siege for the people who are inside, not for Yasser Arafat.
Why was the compound under siege to begin with?
Well, Israel had put Arafat's compound under siege a few times over the previous months, and because the way Israel deals with this situation is basically Yasser Arafat, they tried to make Yasser Arafat the only Palestinian person that the world knows and that the world talks about when it comes to the Palestinian people and this issue, because they have been able to demonize Yasser Arafat and characterize him a certain way, so that by placing him under siege, they seem to draw all the focus just to him and his person. In terms of Bethlehem, we did not run across the square there. In fact, we walked past Israeli soldiers. Indeed, we did not stop when they shouted at us and when they warned us, because we were bringing food to the people inside the Church of the Nativity. And his quote about there being 150 armed gunmen is completely wrong, and was proven to be wrong when the people came out of the church at the end of that siege, when most of the people who were inside were women and children and other civilian men and priests. There were just maybe a couple of dozen armed men who were protecting Bethlehem when, as it was under siege. They had originally been hiding at a mosque across the square from the church. That mosque was bombed, was shelled, by an Israeli tank. And then the people fled across the square, thinking that they would be safe inside the church. Israel had this church under siege for over a month, during which time they did not allow food and medicine and water in, and many people were sick and hungry inside. There's even people who were, after the ISM got in, they discovered that the people inside were eating grass in order to fight off hunger. And so we brought in food and tried to also break the siege and force the international community in some way to do something. So Mr. Hammer, unfortunately, his characterization of all of these activities is purely from the Israeli government's perspective, and he basically could be a mouthpiece for the Israeli government at this point.
I'm speaking with Adam Shapiro. He's an organizer and activist with the International Solidarity Movement. We're talking about an article written by Joshua Hammer in the latest Mother Jones magazine. It's called Death of an Activist. Why don't we get into now his points about Rachel Corrie, because that's what the article is supposed to be focused around. Let's talk about Rafa, where she was. I'll quote for you a description that he gives of Rafa, and then have you respond and just describe the town and what the circumstances were. He says, a town of 150,000 people at the southernmost edge of Gaza, Rafa has been a center of Palestinian resistance for the past 3 years. Masked militants from Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades prowl the city's sandy alleyways at night, past gray cinder block homes and shops whose walls are covered with martyr posters and brightly painted images of assault rifles and exploding Israeli tanks. Nightly gun battles pit Israeli tanks and armored personnel carriers patrolling the border strip, known by the Israelis as the Pink Line, against guerrillas firing anti-tank missiles, grenades, and Kalashnikovs. Roadside bombs lay buried in the sand, and a local Bedouin family controls a lucrative business smuggling weapons from Egypt via tunnels dug as deep as 100 feet and often concealed inside Palestinian homes. Israel's response has been to raise houses considered guerrilla sanctuaries using the D9 bulldozer, a fearsome machine with a 410-horsepower diesel engine, a mine-resistant hulk, and a 7-foot-tall, 14-foot-wide blade that can turn a two-story house into a pile of rubble in 10 minutes. The Israeli military insists that demolitions are carried out with as little pain as possible to civilians. Human intelligence pinpoints homes containing tunnel exits or providing cover for guerrillas. Residents can gather their belongings, and each house is searched for occupants before it is demolished. What is the real situation in Gaza, and what kind of context should this have had instead of just a... seems like a one-sided description to me. Can you respond to it?
Well, the Gaza Strip as a whole is basically a large outdoor prison. The whole strip is fenced around, and now Israel is also building a wall around Gaza Strip. Entry into and out of the Gaza Strip is controlled by the Israeli military, and Palestinians, if they wish to leave, need a special permit from the Israeli government. Palestinians cannot even really access the seashore, which is right along the Gaza Strip, as this is the site of many Israeli settlements and also military positions. And so Gaza Strip, which is an extremely crowded place and very hot, people cannot even get to the water in order to cool off and just sort of take a break from the urban setting, because their mobility to this area is completely restricted. Rafah, which is in the southernmost part of the Gaza Strip, is in a way, in many senses, sort of the ends of the earth. And indeed, the Israeli military maintains a heavy presence at the in this part on the border there between Sinai in Egypt and Rafah in Gaza. The streets of Gaza are indeed sandy and not developed, and the homes are very squalid and somewhat temporary. This is because part of Rafah is also a refugee camp, and I don't know the exact number, but thousands of refugees live in this part of Rafah as well. There is not a single place in Rafah where you can go on a street, in a home, anywhere, where you are out of the sights of an Israeli soldier, sniper, tank, or armored personnel carrier. And so basically all of the citizens of Rafah are essentially targets for the Israeli army. Over 200 homes since the beginning of this intifada have been completely flattened, including the most notorious case, which was about, which was January 2002, I believe, when about 70 homes, give or take a few, were demolished in one day, prompting even people like Shimon Peres and even some more hawkish people in the Israeli government at that time to remark that this was somewhat excessive. People who previously had no trouble bulldozing homes left and right throughout other parts of the Palestinian territories, nonetheless, in one day, about 70 homes, January 2002, were demolished.
Now, was there tunnels underneath all of these homes leading into Egypt in which Palestinian militants were smuggling arms?
Indeed, you know, we know that there are, not just we, I mean, it's common knowledge that there are tunnels to, in some places in the Gaza Strip. Before this intifada, there was a very large expose written, produced by an Israeli television show, about what some of these tunnels were used for, and they were used for drugs that were ending up in Israel, smuggled by Israelis, ecstasy in particular. Women were being trafficked through these tunnels, particularly from Eastern Europe, brought to Sinai, and then trafficked under the tunnels, brought into Israel to work in the sex trade industry. So it has been common knowledge that there are such tunnels, and you know, would it surprise me that weapons have been smuggled in this fashion? No, but it would also not surprise the Israeli military, since these tunnels have been around for a very long time, and there are other ways to cut off the tunnels besides demolishing homes to do so. I seriously doubt that there are tunnels in all of these homes. In fact, the home that Rachel was protecting the day that she was killed, allegedly Israel was claiming that there was a tunnel in this home. This is the home of a doctor, and afterwards, of course, after she was killed, many people went down to visit this home and were in the home, and journalists were there. And there are no tunnels in this home. And so these claims, Israel doesn't seek to verify or to give proof for these tunnels or weapons labs, they often say, are in these homes as well. Rather, they demolish first and then say, this is why. And so we are very skeptical about the particularly extent to which homes have been destroyed, but also that this is the way to do it. If you want to cut off the tunnels, there are other ways to cut off the tunnels. And certainly Egypt has a peace treaty with Israel, and they cooperate with Israel in many ways, and if tunnels wanted to be cut off, they could also be cut off at the source in the Sinai Peninsula as well. So this is just simply Israel is able to go about saying that these weapons are being smuggled and all these things, which I think, while in some cases it may be true, it hardly is to this extent, and certainly this is not the best way to be dealing with this issue.
To be fair to Mr. Hammer, he does go on to say that human rights groups and Palestinians say that the destruction is a form of collective punishment and only rarely meets international definitions of military necessity. He quotes a woman from Human Rights Watch who says that no one questions that tunnels exist or that shooting takes place from Rafah, but she says that she doesn't know if this has anything to do with the scale and size of the house demolitions. He also states that the United Nations says that since the Intifada began in 2001, 582 homes in Rafah have been demolished, and 5,305 people have been made homeless. But he ends his section on Rafah by saying that the IDF says that civilians get caught in crossfire and blame militants for using them as human shields. And he quotes a woman named Sharon Feingold, who's an army spokesman. He quotes her as saying, "It's sad that Palestinian terrorists are using the civilians to hide behind." What do you make of this claim that's so often thrown around that Palestinian militants use civilians to hide behind?
Well, it's a claim we've heard many, many times, and of course we have yet to see any proof of this whatsoever. I have never met Palestinians who have been used as human shields by Palestinian fighters whatsoever, and yet this is a claim that continually gets reported. We have seen, and there is actually video footage of Israeli soldiers using Palestinian civilians as human shields. There are many notorious cases where Israeli soldiers take over Palestinian homes and will lock families in a room in the home and then occasionally pull one person out of the room, stand them in front of a window in the home, and then take up a sniper position behind the person standing in the window and shoot out into the city. For instance, in Nablus this has happened, where it's been well documented, in Jenin. And so, you know, it's one of those claims, of course, where it's a practice that actually Israel is doing, and this is even documented by Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem, and yet the claim is made against Palestinians, and yet we have not heard or seen any evidence of this whatsoever from Palestinians.
Adam, Joshua Hammer claims in his article that when Rachel Corrie was trained at an ISM training, that women were encouraged to wear the hijab. Is this true?
They are not, I mean, they are encouraged insofar as we give cultural training to all of our activists and orientation and let them know sort of what the social mores are in any setting. Gaza is somewhat different than the West Bank in many respects. It's a bit more conservative, socially certainly more conservative. But there are cities also in the West Bank which are more like Gaza. So the training is, of course, particular to where a person is going. And yes, I mean, we told, you know, it has been told to female participants if they're going to Rafah or Gaza or perhaps to Nablus or Jenin that they might feel more comfortable if they wore a headscarf, basically, over their head, because they would be respected more in the community. They would be they wouldn't be a sort harassed in any way, as sometimes is the case. And I don't believe when Rachel first went down there that she did. I don't believe she wore the hijab at first. I think it was after she'd been down there a couple of days and got a feel of the place and talking to people that she felt more comfortable wearing it. It's not in any way a sign of conversion to Islam or anything like that. It is simply a matter of being able to work in a culturally appropriate way in a certain community.
He also, quote here, is Corrie also learned that she had waded into a situation more complex than she'd imagined. Instead of embracing the ISM team as saviors, many Palestinians regarded them with suspicion and even hostility. Have you heard this?
Certainly Palestinians are cautious at first with the ISM, and it should be noted that our presence in Rafah has not been as big as it has been in other places in the West Bank, partially because it is so difficult to access Rafah. It is very difficult for internationals to get access to the Gaza Strip because Israel refuses to allow many humanitarian workers or any sort of peace activists to come into Gaza. So our presence there has not been as big as we'd like it to be. But that's not to say that Rachel was alone. In fact, she wasn't. She was there with about a dozen or so other ISM activists. Yes, the Palestinian people at first in any community we go to are certainly cautious with us. That's because of the long history they've had with foreigners coming into their lands or to their cities and then ultimately not being treated well and not being respected in their own homes or on their own land. And so, and also, I have to say, you know, quite honestly, Palestinians wonder why would foreigners from Europe, from the United States, from wherever, choose to leave their lives at home, even if it's only for 1 week or 2 weeks, and to come to, especially to the Gaza Strip, where you can see on TV how dangerous it is and how difficult the life is and the kind of situation it is. And so, you know, for Palestinians who this has become normal for, their, unfortunately and tragically, their life like this has become normal, yet they still have to wonder, and I think it's perfectly understandable that they wonder why somebody would come, you know, and not to be too stereotypical, but somebody who's blonde-haired and blue-eyed like Rachel, why she would leave her home in the United States and come to Gaza to be with them and to suffer in this way. That she entered a more complex situation than she thought before she got to the occupied territories, I think that's true of all of us who've gone, and anybody who's gone to cover or to live in the occupied Palestinian territories, and as is probably the case in other countries around the world as well. What you can learn about, what you can experience, and what you can see about a place, particularly a place like the West Bank or Gaza, from the comfort of your home in the United States, in no way compares, in no way gives you full access or information about a place until you get there and are living there and you see the real life and the real situation for itself. And I think Rachel captured that beautifully in her emails that she sent home, and I think it's also reflected in the emails that she sent home, how well she adapted to life in the Gaza Strip and how well the community in Rafah embraced her and the other ISM activists.
I just wanted to mention, I forgot to mention, the Gaza Strip is, can you describe just briefly, how large is it? And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that about one-third of Gaza is occupied by about 6,700 Israeli settlers, while the other two-thirds, 1 million Palestinians, are crowded into that area. Is that true?
Indeed, more than 1 million Palestinians, and it is, Gaza Strip is, the Gaza City is the most densely populated place on earth. Indeed, Israeli settlement activity has taken place in the Gaza Strip, and yes, whole swaths of land are taken up by a very small number of settlers. In fact, it's quite shocking when you're driving south in the main north-south highway, not highway, road in the Gaza Strip, you'll be driving along just north of Gaza City and then into Gaza City and then just south of Gaza City, and it's a very dusty place. It's dry, desert-like, very, very crowded, squalid conditions, and then all of a sudden the road takes a sort of a detour and you start to see a high fence and lush greenery and beautiful homes that look like they belong in Southern California, and you keep driving past this place and it takes a while to get past, and then you go, you detour back towards the main road and you're proceeding south again on the Palestinian road in Gaza. And again, it's dry and dusty and desert-like and squalid. And you realize the discrepancy of life between the Israeli settlers who live in this lush green area where they take the water for the rest of the Gaza Strip and pour it into this parcel of this one-third of the Gaza Strip, which is inhabited by just a few thousand Israeli settlers who are there illegally, according to international law, and see the discrepancy between that and the way that the over a million Palestinians have forced to live.
I want to conclude by talking about Rachel Corrie's killing, as well as the shooting of Tom Herndahl, Brian Avery. I won't get into that so much, just a few facts on that, but I'm focusing on Rachel Corrie's killing because that's what the article focuses on. And again, you're listening to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Adam Shapiro. He's an organizer and activist with the International Solidarity Movement. I'm getting his reaction to an article in the latest Mother Jones magazine called Death of an Activist, Was Rachel Corrie a Martyr or a Fool, by Joshua Hammer. Now he begins talking about Rachel Corrie's killing, and he prefaces it by saying that on the morning, on the day in which she was killed, that she was propelled, this is a quote, "She was propelled in part by frustration. During the past few days, she and the nine other ISM activists had become preoccupied with an anonymous letter circulating through Rafa that cast suspicion on the human shields." And it goes on to describe that one of the reasons why they decided to take more direct action or to directly challenge the Israeli military more was because of this letter. Is this true, or had they been challenging the Israeli military all along?
They had absolutely been challenging the Israeli military all along. There is a video of a night in Rafah, a couple of nights before Rachel was killed, in which she and another activist are in a home, a Palestinian home, literally, facing the Israeli tanks that are on the border, and you can hear throughout the night the Israeli tanks shooting at Rafah, and you really only hear fire coming from the tanks and the armored personnel carriers into the city, and you hear them calling to the other activists in the town and finding out who's where and are any Palestinians hurt or injured, can they move around to get to protect other people, are ambulances trying to get in. This is a video, of course, this has not been made public. It's a video that her family has. They had been going out and repairing a water well that had been continually damaged and destroyed by Israeli tanks, and it was in an area that the Israelis would not allow Palestinian engineers to go fix, and so part of Rafah was cut off from water because of this, and they had been going out to this well to repair it, escorting Palestinians out there, and this was in direct violation or a direct challenge to the Israeli army. So to say that they were frustrated and looking for something to prove themselves is really just false. And I don't know where Mr. Hammer found or discovered this letter, but this is the first I've heard of it, and I've never seen any sort of mention of this letter or any sort of feelings of this, of frustration or anything like that, in any of Rachel's writings that she sent home to her family and to her friends. And we have all of those emails. Her family has made those public, and those have been reproduced in the Guardian newspaper, in the Los Angeles Times, and in a few other publications.
Harper's Magazine. He does mention the well, and he says that the attack on the well by the Israeli army had indeed cut off half the water supply of the city. But he says that the Israeli military claims that gunmen had fired from the well houses of these wells upon the Rafi Yam settlement.
I mean, this is what they always claim, what the Israeli army always claims. It wasn't one attack on the well. Before Rachel got to Rafah, other ISMers were working to try and fix this well from previous times when the Israeli army had run over it with a bulldozer or with a tank. And so it was just simply a policy. Because the well was close to the settlement, the Israelis would run over it with their tanks and patrolling, and they did not want Palestinians to come near the settlement in order to fix the well. And so they left the well broken. And rather than fix it for the Palestinians, they would rather just simply have the Palestinians cut off from water. And this had been going on for months and months and months, long before Rachel even got to Rafah.
He mentions, he begins talking about the day she was killed, and he mentions that Israel claims that what the crew's assignment was that day was to sweep the area for booby traps planted by militants. They claim they weren't intending on demolishing the doctor's home. He goes on to say the ISM team insists that it was another house demolition mission. What's the truth on that?
Well, I mean, the fact that they didn't demolish a house that day doesn't mean that they weren't trying to demolish a house, and it is quite possible that our activists were successful in preventing a home demolition. Now, Rachel was tragically killed, and so this her life doesn't justify a successful day in the sense of preventing a home demolition. In fact, the doctor whose home she was standing in front of later, you know, when he was crying, told a journalist that he would gladly give up, you know, his home in order to have Rachel back. You know, that they were sweeping the area. This is the first that our activists would have seen is D9 bulldozers roaming an area, sweeping for booby traps, and not coming to do a home demolition.
Okay, he mentions that, I'll just quote here and get your reaction. 5 members of the ISM team were in place by the time Corey and 2 others arrived. Positioned near Nasrallah's house, that's the doctor, they waved banners, called to the troops through their megaphones, and attempted to obstruct the bulldozer's movements. At 3:04, soldiers in the tank fired warning shots at the protesters to, quote, no effect, the Israeli military says. 17 minutes later, they launched shock grenades and tear gas, again to, quote, no effect. At 3:28, work was temporarily suspended. Then, at 4:15, according to a military log, quote, 20 Palestinians crouch east of the road. A grenade is tossed at a D9, unquote. The troops fired more tear gas to disperse the crowd. Now, to me, this sounds like he's describing a crowd of people that includes the ISM and 20 Palestinians that threw grenades at a D9. What is...
I mean, there's been absolutely no reports of this whatsoever from our activists, from the eyewitnesses, including Palestinians who talked to journalists and talked to others who came to investigate. And it's utterly, utterly ridiculous to believe that the Israeli army would respond to grenades with tear gas. It's utterly ridiculous and has been, we have months and months and months of this fighting going on to prove that this is not the way the Israeli army deals with being with facing sniper fire or attacks or anything of the sort, with grenades or anything like that. So, you know, this is pure spin. What happened from our eyewitnesses who were there was that the first sort of encounter with the bulldozers, the ISMers were able to get the tanks. The bulldozers to turn back. And later, one bulldozer tried to come back towards the house of the doctor, and Rachel saw it, and she went out with the others behind her, trailing behind her. She got to the tank, to the bulldozer first, managed to get in front of it, got up on a mound of dirt so she was visible to the driver, and was shouting at him, was wearing a orange fluorescent vest so she was clearly identified. The others came up and were shouting to the driver. They even had a megaphone shouting at the driver of the bulldozer, and yet he continued. He piled up dirt in such a way that Rachel was trapped under the dirt, and then he proceeded to roll over her, and then backed up and rolled over her again.
Joshua,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, after a few months with Rachel's family pursuing, trying to get an investigation conducted by the American government, the Israeli government and military released an initial sort of military investigation. And one thing that they gave to the family is a videotape shot from a guard tower far away. You can't see anything. You can see sort of a tiny little outline of a bulldozer moving and specks that, you know, don't show any detail of people or anything like that. But there is radio broadcast between this bulldozer driver and the tower, and in Hebrew, the driver says, "I ran over something. I ran over somebody." And so the driver knew that he ran somebody over.
They asked, Joshua Hammer asked the question here, was it murder? And then he says, Corey's colleagues believe that it was. He quotes a man named Joe Smith, who in an affidavit stated that it was an intentional killing. He says, I saw it, and I know he saw her, I know he did, and I know he knew she was still under the bulldozer when it backed up without raising its blade. I don't know if he wanted to kill her, or if he was just focused on doing his work and didn't care if he killed her or not. I don't know which is scarier. But then he goes on to say, quote, yet Smith later gave an interview in which he acknowledged that the bulldozer operator could well have lost sight of Corey after she tumbled down the dirt pile. Does that sound like a contradiction to you?
It doesn't sound like a contradiction to me. As I said, the bulldozer driver piled up dirt onto Rachel, and she was trapped underneath, and nobody denies that after the initial push of dirt by the bulldozer driver, Rachel was trapped under the dirt that the driver had put on top of her, and then he continued to roll over her. So did he intentionally roll over her the second time, or was it unintentional? I don't believe it's unintentional because he rolled forwards and backwards, and we do have the audio of him saying, I ran over somebody. And we also, look, if I mean, the only, this bulldozer driver has never spoken to anybody, as far as we know, the military did not interview him.
There's a quote in here from the driver.
From the driver or from the...
From the driver. And I can share it with you and you can respond to it.
Sure.
It says, quote, Dubey, the Army reservist who ran Corey down, is a Russian immigrant with long experience as a bulldozer operator. On Israeli TV, he insisted that his field of vision was limited inside the D9 cabin and that he had no idea Corey was in front of the machine. Quote, you can't hear, you can't see well. You can go over something and you'll never know, he said. Quote, I scooped up some earth. I couldn't see anything. I pushed the earth. I didn't see her at all. Maybe she was hiding in there. Unquote.
Well, we know that this is not true. We know that we have pictures of Rachel standing in front and atop the earth before she was killed, fully visible to the driver. We know that the other activists were shouting to him that there was somebody there waving their arms frantically, so he could have seen them at least motioning. And we know that he said he ran somebody over. We do also know from another bulldozer driver in Jenin camp who described back in April 2002 his experience of bulldozing homes in the Jenin refugee camp. And it was quite clear from him, who was driving the same model bulldozer, that he could see what he was knocking down, that his field of vision indeed is limited to some extent, but indeed he could see clearly what was in front of him. And this was a man who admitted to drinking heavily on the job, but also talked freely and clearly about what he did see as he was driving his bulldozer through the Jenin refugee camp, demolishing home after home after home. And if we judge the character of the bulldozer drivers by the one from the Jenin refugee camp and by this other one in Gaza, then and I can also speak from personal experience in encountering all different ranks and jobs of soldiers throughout the Army, I can say that it's not the most elite soldiers that end up driving the bulldozers. I don't have any doubt that this driver proceeded over Rachel Corey. I believe he did it intentionally.
Do you have time for a few more questions, Adam?
Sure.
Okay. This is a quote again from the article. The IDF compiled a video about the Corey incident that includes footage taken from inside the cockpit of a D9, not the D9, but
right.
A D9. It makes a credible case that the operators, peering out through narrow, double-glazed, bulletproof windows, their view obscured behind pistons and the giant scooper, might not have seen Corey kneeling in front of them.
Well, there's no evidence that she was kneeling. There's no. This is the Israeli version, but our pictures and our eyewitnesses all explain that she was initially standing, and then when she was crushed under the dirt, she was forced to the ground. So at the initial point of contact, she indeed was standing. She was visible wearing an orange jacket, fluorescent, that should be protecting her. And, I mean, look, if the bulldozer drivers can't see what they're doing, then I think the next question, or perhaps the first question we should be asking the Israeli military, is why they are sending people into civilian areas, driving bulldozers and demolishing homes and cars and all kinds of things, when they can't see what they're doing. This, to me, would be the first logical question.
Adam, let's talk briefly about some of the other people that have been killed or injured. Brian Avery, well, I'm just talking about internationals here. I'll clarify that. There's thousands of Palestinians that have been killed in the occupied territories, civilians. In rapid succession, Israeli troops shot three more, this is a quote, foreign civilians working in the West Bank and Gaza. On April 5th, Brian Avery, a 24-year-old American ISM volunteer in Jenin, was shot in the face by an Israeli sniper, it says, and seriously wounded. 6 days later, a bullet fired by an Israeli soldier in a Rafah watchtower tore through the back of a 21-year-old Tom Herndahl's skull as the ISM volunteers stooped to carry two Palestinian girls to safety. Herndahl now lies comatose in a British hospital. On May 2nd, James Miller, a 35-year-old Briton filming an HBO documentary along the Egyptian border, was shot in the neck and killed while walking under a white flag toward an Israeli APC. Few suggest that the army is deliberately targeting foreign activists and journalists, but critics say that these casualties are the inevitable result of a shoot-first, ask-questions-later policy, one that has resulted in the deaths of hundreds of Palestinian non-combatants. Now, let me quote a little further and get your response. Quote, "We do not target civilians," IDF spokesman Feingold assured me. In the case of Herndahl, she said, quote, "A gunman was coming out of a house and started shooting, and a single shot was fired toward this gunman. Herndahl was hit," unquote. Miller, she explains, was, quote, "outside filming in pitch-black darkness just as someone fired an anti-tank rocket from somewhere nearby and the soldiers returned fire," unquote. Can you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we can go through case by case and talk about if it was pitch-black darkness, how could James Miller actually be filming something? If he's using a camera and it's pitch-black, then he can't see anything. In the case of Tom Herndahl, there's been no evidence whatsoever by anybody, no proof, no eyewitnesses to explain even that there was a gunman in the area, or that this shot was fired in any way at a different location other than directly at Tom Herndahl's head. These are the specifics of it. I mean, but looking at the pattern in general, which also I should mention includes Ian Hook, who was the UNRWA director in Jenin, who was shot and killed in his office by the Israeli military, and Quiva Butterly, another international activist who was shot in the leg in Jenin as well. That the pattern, yes, it's true, Israel does shoot first and ask questions later. I think that this has been proven not just by the shootings of these internationals, but of the thousands of Palestinians that have been shot, injured, and killed.
There was also an AP photographer who happened to be correct. Palestinian who was shot and killed
well,
as well.
Well, many Palestinian journalists have been shot and killed, more than one.
In all of these cases, was there a Palestinian gunman in a doorway nearby that just happened to fire near their head?
Almost always. Either a Palestinian gunman or somebody throwing a grenade, or there's always something.
But not according to eyewitnesses, according to the Israeli military later, because my understanding about Tom Herndahl's situation is that all of the eyewitnesses said there was no gunfire whatsoever except from the Israeli sniper.
Indeed. So, and, it's a shame. It's really a shame that, unfortunately, the ISM does not have the financial resources at this point to ensure that we have cameras in the hands of every single one of our activists, video cameras throughout the occupied territories, so that there we would be able to give more than just simply dozens of eyewitness accounts, but also video proof of these types of things as well. So it is unfortunate. In the case of James Miller, there was another cameraman with Reuters, I believe, who was there, who also testified that the snipers could see, the Israeli snipers could see the journalists moving there, that they had made verbal contact with them as well, and yet they were shot anyway. We know from March and April 2002, when journalists in Ramallah and in Bethlehem were shot at by Israeli soldiers, journalists with CNN, with the BBC, who were shot at by Israeli soldiers, that the Israeli army does target journalists. Anthony Shadid, a Boston Globe journalist, was shot in the shoulder and ended up in a hospital in Ramallah, shot by Israeli snipers. So we know that this is the case. It's happened over and over again, and yet Israel conveniently manages to find the excuse of the hidden terrorist somewhere.
I have just two final questions for you. Basically, Joshua Hammer, toward the end of the article, begins to paint the ISM as falling apart, as being psychologically, downtrodden, as basically not being able to hold up under the pressure of these killings and woundings and things. And then he only briefly mentions the fact that Representative Brian Baird has called for a congressional investigation into Corey's killing. He doesn't tell anyone what the anything more than that. Can you talk about how the ISM is responding to this, how they're doing, and a little bit about the congressional investigation, where it's at?
Well, the ISM has continued its work, and indeed the loss of Rachel and the shootings of Tom and Brian were traumatic and forced the ISM to really think deeply and hard about what we're doing and to speak to the Palestinian community, to engage with them in the kind of activities that we're involved with them, and how to improve our work, and to come to terms also with the fact that no matter how many precautions we can take and have taken, ultimately responsibility in these cases does fall on the shoulders of the Israeli army, who continues to conduct military operations and assaults and attacks in and against civilian targets. This summer, ISM conducted its second Freedom Summer campaign, and we were highly active, particularly against the apartheid wall that's being built in the West Bank. And we were able to force open gates in the wall that to allow Palestinian farmers to access their land. We were able to stand in front of bulldozers that were trying to clear more land to build the wall and to effectively block construction of the wall on a few occasions in the West Bank. So we continued to take direct action and continue to stand with the Palestinian people for freedom and for an end to occupation. And if Mr. Hammer wishes to present the ISM as some sort of organization that's falling apart, well, I mean, I think he and others, if they believe that, will be shocked when they continue to see the ISM working and standing with the Palestinian people. And I'm sure he didn't mention this, but it's also, the ISM has also been nominated by three separate parties for a Nobel Peace Prize. And so I find it strange to think he would characterize the ISM in such a way.
Has there been a congressional investigation, or is there still an effort in that area?
Well, there still is a resolution being pushed by Brian Baird's office to get Congress to call for an investigation. There has not been one yet. There are about 40-odd signatures on the resolution, which is a far cry from what is needed, and also what we believe should be the responsibility of Congress in pursuing justice and pursuing an investigation into the killing of an American citizen, in particularly by the military of one of its allies, and in particular by a weapon, a machine that was given to the Israeli army by United States military aid.
How can we press for that?
Well, call your Congress people, encourage them to sign the Rachel Corrie resolution, and basically ask your Congress people why they allow the killing of an American citizen to go by unremarked, uninvestigated, and continue to allow the weapons, the type of weapon that killed Rachel Corrie, to continue to be sold to the Israeli government. And also call Caterpillar and let them know that you do not believe that it is in their company's interest or that it is legitimate that they continue to provide bulldozers to Israel to demolish homes and to destroy lives.
I'm going to quote one final quote from this article and get your response. He says, no matter what one thinks of Corrie, her death should have prompted more of a conversation. She should be an iconic figure. To foolish idealism, to bravery against impossible odds, to the bittersweet conviction of youth, and to a handful of people she may be, but so far the larger message of her life appears to be one of futility. How would you remember Rachel Corrie, and how do you remember her, and how do you respond to this?
Well, first of all, Mr. Hammer is ridiculously arrogant to say that she has foolish idealism. Rachel was hardly a fool and saw for herself, from experience living with the people in Rafah, what exactly those people are up against in seeking freedom. Mr. Hammer, I don't think does justice to her experience in her life, particularly in the last few days of her life. In this article, it's certainly clear to me. Rachel is still remembered. There is a lot of people around the world who continue to talk about her, who remember her. I recently was traveling in Lebanon and Jordan and in Malaysia, and everybody there, when they found out I was with the International Solidarity Movement or that I had spent time in the occupied Palestinian territories, would talk about Rachel Corrie. Everybody from all walks of life and all ages. Here in the United States, I was recently told by a friend who spoke at the Black what's it called, the Black Radical Congress or something like that, where there was a poetry reading talking about reparations for slavery and other issues for the African-American community, that one of the poets spoke in the poem about Rachel Corrie and tying her life and her work for social justice to that of the conference that he was speaking at. And so Rachel does, I mean, is she iconic like a Che Guevara figure? Certainly not. But she certainly is a symbol to a lot of people. And I think more than anything, especially for me, shows that as American citizens, particularly today, in the day and age that we're living in, that we need to take responsibility for the policies and the actions of our governments around the world, and that we need to not just sit at home and complain about it, but to get out into the world and engage with the people around the world and stand up and say what is right and what is wrong.
I want to thank you so much for joining me today, Adam. Adam Shapiro is an organizer and activist with the International Solidarity Movement. I appreciate all the time you've given to this. And I know you're very busy, but I'd like to suggest that you write a letter to the Mother Jones magazine in response to this. Hopefully other people will as well.
I certainly will.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. And if you want more information, I want to give you a couple websites. One of them is palsolidarity.org. That's the International Solidarity Movement's website. PAL, P-A-L, solidarity.org, palsolidarity.org. And there on that website, you can read eyewitness accounts of Rachel Corrie's killing, as well as you can read about the congressional investigation that Representative Brian Baird from Washington is calling for. You can find out how you can support that resolution, how you can pressure your congresspeople to sign on to this. There's also a website called rachelcorrie.org, and her name is spelled rachelcorrie.org, rachelcorrie.org. At this website, you can learn more about Rachel Corrie and about what you can do to get a congressional investigation into her killing. Thanks so much for listening.